Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Coming up, we'll hear Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV, a panel discussion about state and local politics. And later in this program, we'll meet two of the speakers at the upcoming Darwin Day celebration. That's later on in the program. First, two listener comments about last Friday's program. Last Friday, we continued to talk about the impeachment trial of President Trump and also the proposal to build a giant fish farm in the Gulf of Mexico off the waters of Sarasota. Here's what two listeners had to say.
Hi, this is Mark in Temple Terrace. Seems like in regards to Friday's show and the whole impeachment thing, seems like the Democrats only really got to the point of impeachment when Trump went after one of theirs. And by one of theirs, I mean, you know, centrist, pretty well-to-do, mainstream part of the establishment, which is Joe Biden. Kind of makes me wonder how this would have all played out if the Democrats actually had spines and had instead tried to impeach or whatever against Trump around issues that more than a small bubble of people actually understand and care about, you know, whether it's actual crimes against humanity that this administration has been committing against migrants on the border and elsewhere, or, you know, exacerbating the existential threat of climate change, whether it's having white supremacists like Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller in the administration. You know, one has to wonder how this would all have played out.
This is Jeff from Tarpon Springs. I was listening about the fish farm, and it seemed to remind me of what Mr. Trump just pencil-whipped to limit the EPA on just about everything. When they did that, that day is when they said that Chicago and all sorts of other big cities had bad water. But now it's okay to put things in the water.
A couple of listener comments that came after Friday's program. This is Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. I'm Rob Loray. Thanks for tuning in. We're going to hear a discussion about some of the issues involving the state of Florida and local government. And the program that we're about to hear is Florida This Week. It's something I host on Friday nights on WEDU, the PBS TV station in Tampa. And as we're listening back to the program, you can always comment about the topics. You can send your comments in to dj@wmnf.org. You can just write to that email address, dj@wmnf.org. Here is Florida This Week. Coming up next, Florida's junior U.S. senator buys an unusual political ad in Iowa. Former State Attorney General Pam Bondi defends the president on the floor of the U.S. Senate. The bill to make it harder for teens to obtain an abortion gets closer to passage in Tallahassee. And state workers say they need a pay raise. Political Insights next on Florida This Week. Welcome back. This week our panelists are Adam Smith is a political consultant for Mercury Public Affairs. Mike Fasano is the Pasco County tax collector and a Republican. Holly Gregory is an anchor and reporter at Spectrum Bay News 9. And Lisa Perry is the co-founder of the Common Ground Florida Project and a Democrat. So nice to see you, everybody. Great to have you here.
Thank you.
Well, Florida's Senator Rick Scott spent some money on a political ad this week, even though he's not running for office. The wealthy former hospital investor injected himself into the 2020 presidential race, airing an ad in Iowa days ahead of the caucus there by attacking the Democratic-led impeachment trial against President Trump and accusing former Vice President Joe Biden of corruption. The ad from the politically ambitious Republican U.S. Senator was not just aimed at the current race, but also signaled his ambitions for 2024 when he's up for re-election or free to pursue higher political ambitions.
I'm Rick Scott, one of the jurors in the U.S. Senate. I'd like to thank the Democrats for badly botching this impeachment charade.
The unusually timed ad by a non-candidate helps boost his name recognition in the crucial battleground state of Iowa should he decide to run for president in 2024. Mike? What's Rick Scott up to?
Well, he's definitely running for president in 2024. Whether Donald Trump gets reelected or not, that's going to be an open seat for president. But Rick Scott did this years ago, if you recall, when he was on TV long before he was governor, talking about health care and bashing the Obamacare. And he did that, I think, as a prelude to run for governor of the state of Florida, and of course was successful. What's laughable, though, that he's attacking someone of being a crook when he pleaded, 75 times not wanting to answer any questions when he had some issues long ago. I'm not a fan of Joe Biden, not going to support him, but Rick Scott ought to stay in Florida. And as a jurist, the last thing he should be doing is talking about how he's going to vote and critical of anyone until that vote comes up.
Adam, in that ad, he calls himself a hostage along with 99 other U.S. senators. I mean, he seemed to say that this process is unnecessary, the impeachment process is unnecessary, and he felt like a victim in the process.
I think that's kind of the standard line for most of the senators these days, or the Republicans, to say this is a farce and this is a waste of time. I think probably almost no Iowan who's being deluged with robocalls and TV ads paid any attention. But the two people who paid real close attention were Governor Ron DeSantis and Senator Marco Rubio, because they will be likely jockeying for the same hardcore Republican primary vote in that presidential election.
Does it show that Rick Scott has too much money left in his campaign account to be able to run a campaign ad so far away from the 2024 election?
I think it's just sort of planting his flag, and it's really not to the voters of Iowa. It's probably to the guy in the White House as a reminder that I've got your back, and mostly to sort of the political establishment in the Beltway to say, listen, I'm going to be a contender next time around. Pay attention to me.
And Holly, I think it's so unusual for somebody to run an ad like this so far out. I mean, Mike said that he's done it before on healthcare issues.
Yes.
Conservatives for Patients' Rights, was
that's
that the
correct
group?
Yes, sir.
But it is so unusual for somebody to inject themselves in. And Adam made an interesting point, that is that, you know, this may be, you know, lost in all the other ads that people are getting in Iowa.
Well, I lived and worked in Iowa, worked for the NBC affiliate there, covered the caucuses there, and I've had a chance to talk to some of my friends who are still there at the station as they're covering the caucus now to get their reaction to this ad airing, and that is certainly true. You know, they're so inundated right now with political ads that is it really getting through to voters? That's questionable. But who is paying attention? People who are really into politics and the political observers there, because every Iowa caucus comes the issue of should we continue letting them be the first in the nation, and there is a lot of pressure right now for Iowa Democrats to pick the right candidate, to pick a winner, or they might lose their leadoff caucus. So to see somebody already positioning themselves for 2024 sends a message to Iowans that they matter beyond Monday's caucus.
Mm-hmm. Lisa, what do you think of Rick Scott and running for president?
I think that there will be an appetite for Trumpism in 2024, and I think that he's making a statement to GOP voters that he wants to be part of that conversation. So
he'll pick up where Trump has left off.
I do, regardless of the outcome in November. I think that, you know, that's the tone he's setting the table, and he's ready to go.
But Florida is not, as Adam said, Florida is not without Republicans that want to run for president. Whether it's Marco Rubio or whether it's Governor DeSantis or maybe even Jeb Bush, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think people see DeSantis as one of the potential front runners, and so I think this is a way for Senator Rick Scott to get out ahead of that and set the tone that he's already vying for that position, and so it'll be really interesting.
You know, it'd be interesting to play back the tape around that election time to see, was it wise to be your number one cheerleader for Donald Trump during this impeachment crisis? And we're going to know a lot better to see whether Donald Trump's reelected or not. It looks like 50-50 now, but, you know, many of these Republicans were Jeb Bush Republicans at one time, just mainstream Republicans, Mike Fasano Republicans. And they are the hostages who were so worried about their hard right primary voters that they have to superglue themselves to Donald Trump.
Well, Mike, I got to ask you that. Has that wing of the party really disappeared? The Jeb Bush wing of the party, is it completely gone, out of power, never to come back?
Oh, I don't think it's never to come back, but certainly for the next few years, and especially if Donald Trump gets reelected, it's the Donald Trump party is what it is. And again, We all thought that years ago the party had changed as well when we saw Rick Scott get elected along with others. And it comes back, no different than the Democratic Party. Unfortunately, right now, what we're seeing is one individual who has captured the Republicans, that audience, and a solid support for him. And he's able to carry the day, if you will, carry the banner in the Republican Party. And we'll see what happens. But certainly Rick Scott is on those coattails, wants to be on those coattails if Donald Trump gets reelected.
Okay. Well, former Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, who is part of President Trump's defense team in the U.S. Senate trial, went on offense this week against Vice President Joe Biden and his son Hunter. For 30 minutes, the Tampa Republican raised questions about why Hunter Biden was appointed to the Ukrainian gas company Burisma's board in 2014 while his father was vice president. She pointed out that Hunter Biden knew little about the energy industry or Ukraine and that he was very well paid.
The House managers talked about the Bidens of Burisma 400 times, but they never gave you the full picture. But here are those who did. The United Kingdom Serious Fraud Unit, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State George Kent, Chris Hines, the ABC White House reporter, ABC, Good Morning America, The Washington Post, The New York Times, Ukrainian law enforcement, and the Obama State Department itself.
So, Adam, those were news stories that she was citing that cast doubt on the
Trump administration is very fond of the New York Times and the Washington Post. It's no surprise they would cite them.
But how did Bondi do? I mean, did she land any blows that made a serious dent in either Joe Biden's reputation or did it show any sort of wrongdoing or lawbreaking by Hunter Biden?
Here's what I mean. I think her performance was not especially memorable, but it was fine. And I think pretty much every objective observer of both parties that follow this issue knows that the prosecutor that involved, he was the problem. He was not fighting corruption, and that's why
this is the prosecutor that Biden got pushed out.
Yeah. But anytime you're talking about Hunter Biden, I'm sorry, being having this cushy job with this industry, it's sleazy. Mm-hmm. Was it legal? Apparently, it's legal, but Americans get it. It's sleazy. So anytime you're talking about that, it's hurtful to Joe Biden.
As I was watching Pam Bondi make her presentation on Monday, I noticed that she kept pointing out the dates, 2014, 2015. These were dates where the House was investigating Hillary Clinton of Benghazi. They could have, I think, made an investigation at that point because these news reports were coming out in 2014, 2015.
I agree, but I think that what we need to look at is the fact that Joe Biden was working on behalf of the position of not only the U.S. government, but also widely supported, support throughout the world and globally. And so there's no... It is known, as Adam had said, that we realized that Hunter Biden's role was although not in good standing and it's a little frowned upon, but I do think that everything was above the lines here. Burisma was actually put on hold at that point in time, and when you look into it, really what it comes down to is that I think that Joe Biden had really gone after what he was supposed to do on his in his role as a vice president and in conjunction with our government's wishes.
Mike, does this enhance Pam Bondi's reputation if she should choose to run for higher office here in Florida?
I think so. She's well known. She's well liked. But getting back to the Biden issue, in politics, I found out that perception is everything. And if you're the vice president of the United States and your son gets this cushy job, and it was a cushy job, making a lot of money each month and doing very little, people are going to ask questions. And they should have been smarter than that. And although there's no proof that the vice president did anything wrong, again, perception is everything. And when you hear Pam Bondi list those dates and those stories, people do think right away, well, his son was making all this money. He got that job not because he knew what he was doing. He got that job because his father was the vice president of the United States. So, again, perception is everything in politics.
So, Holly, if we go into the campaign and Biden is the nominee, this issue What do you think that happens to this issue?
Oh, I certainly think it comes right back to the forefront. And, you know, Bondi said it's nepotistic at best, it's nefarious at worst. And as far as that first presentation by her, she was a little shaky on her second one, but that first one was very well received by conservatives. What's interesting, too, is that three networks cut away from her. They carried all of Adam Schiff before her, then she came up and they cut away from Bondi when she made that case. And as far as the argument that Joe Biden was following U.S. policy, he went out before the Council of Foreign Relations and he's on tape saying, you know, I told him you want that $1 billion, then you get rid of this prosecutor. Conservatives just don't buy the argument that because it was U.S. policy and Viktor Shokin was corrupt or not going after corruption, that that somehow clears him. They don't quite buy that argument, and they keep saying, okay, you say it's debunked, but debunked by whom? Mm-hmm. Who's really investigated this? Yeah. I guess the answer is Giuliani.
Yeah.
Where that ended up is another story.
And he's pretty quiet about it. So does this end up, if Biden is the nominee, does this end up being the what they use to swift boat or target Biden every week, every hour with campaign commercials?
I think yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's one of a number of things they'll use constantly. Yeah, they'll throw anything. There's a stench to this cushy job that somebody that doesn't really have a lot of experience getting paid a ton of money, obviously because of his father's position. Right. It may be legal, but it's, you know, nothing's fair, all's fair in politics, whatever. I don't know where they'll throw it at him.
And China is still out there as a question, too, where he made money.
Yeah.
Well, in Tallahassee, a bill that would require girls under the age of 18 to have parents' written permission before having an abortion is set for a full Senate vote after Democrats failed this week to weaken the legislation. The bill would require a minor to get written, notarized permission from a parent or a legal guardian in order to obtain an abortion. Florida already requires that doctors notify parents before performing an abortion on a minor. Democrats filed more than two dozen amendments to the bill but failed to make any changes. The Senate will vote on the bill in the coming week. Over in the House, a similar bill is also ready for a vote. So, Holly, what are the arguments for and against this bill?
Well, you know, I just interviewed yesterday Anna Escamani, Democrat lawmaker from Orlando. She was at the rally on the anniversary of Roe versus Wade in Tallahassee for abortion rights. She worked at Planned Parenthood for a time. And basically she explained to me that nationally about 4% of abortions are performed on minors. And of those, about two-thirds have a parent that is involved. And for the parents that aren't involved, there's usually a reason along the lines of abuse or incest or something awful like that. So she believes that there's a minuscule amount of people that this law actually would apply to. Florida already has a notification for parents. This takes it a step further to get consent. But what it's really about in the minds of Democrats and abortion rights advocates is testing the courts, setting up a court battle, the new makeup of the conservative state courts. Even the Supreme Court is set to take this issue up, a Louisiana case on abortion this summer. So there's a whole new ball game as far as abortion goes right now.
Mike, Florida isn't the only state that's passing tougher laws on abortion.
Yes.
Is Holly right? I mean, do people who are a right to life view this as the time to push this issue all the way to the Florida Supreme Court and to the U.S. Supreme Court?
I believe they are. I mean, as Holly pointed out, we have a totally different Florida Supreme Court today. Not one that would have struck down a law like this had it passed years and years ago. So I think it's an opportunity for pro-life, the pro-lifers, if you will, to maybe pass some legislation they feel, good about there, and put it before the courts to see how far they can go. When I was in the legislature, we passed, and Adam was around, we passed many pro-life laws that were struck down by the Florida Supreme Court. With the new Florida Supreme Court, I believe it is an opportunity for pro-life groups to be able to pass legislation as legislators as well, and bring it before the courts to see if they will they'll hold up on those on that new law.
And do you think that Roe v. Wade is the actual target, though? I mean, that is the actual target.
Well, the only way you're going to get to Roe v. Wade is if you get it, go back to the United States Supreme Courts. And as much as we are, and I am a pro-life individual, I've come to the realization to change the major part of regarding abortion is going to have to go before the United States Supreme Court.
Lisa, what do you think about this? I mean, how upset are pro-choice groups around the state? There's going to be a protest this Tuesday in Tallahassee.
I think this is a huge deal. You know, it's definitely a Trojan horse legislative bill that is certainly to start and initiate a lawsuit that would eventually be aimed at undermining Roe v. Wade and an all-out ban on abortion. I think that the authors of the bill have not demonstrated a need for this action, as you had stated, that we already have in place parental consent that plays part of this, and minors that do not choose to participate in the parental consent with the doctors, there's usually a very good reason for that. And so I think this jeopardizes a lot of our youth who is the most at stake. And I also think that we are going to see this lead to more invasive and later term abortions when younger minors are unable to get access to abortions in a safe way.
Do you sense that the Florida House and Senate are both going to pass this bill?
I would not doubt it in our current political climate.
If I may, this also has to do whether where the governor is. They certainly don't want to send him a bill that he feels uncomfortable in signing. He's very much pro-life, no doubt about it. But is it something that's, you know, is it something to pass and put before a governor that will only be struck down by the higher courts down the road?
Mm-hmm. Well, Adam, what about that? I mean, if the Florida Supreme Court has now a strong conservative majority on it...
I'm struck by a couple things. One, Mike, I was a Cub reporter and watching these same exact debates go on. I mean, it's just never, it's the same thing over and over again. This time it'll probably pass, and it'll go to presumably the court will pass it. I'm not sure there are valid reasons to be opposed to it, if that's your point of view, but I'm not sure it's a radical idea or a politically dangerous idea to suggest a parent should be involved in their 14-year-old daughter's, should be aware of abortion. I don't know that that's a horrible, I don't think that sounds horrible to
but
a
to,
lot of
to
people.
Go the next step and get a notarized statement from your parents saying that it's okay when you've already got your parents' permission.
But again, I don't think it's going to be that hard for Republicans to defend this once it passes.
Okay. Well, State Senator Bill Galvano of Bradenton says he's keeping his pledge to try to raise the pay of state workers.
The Florida Senate released its $92.8 billion spending plan for next year. It includes a 3% pay raise for state employees and additional money for public school teachers. It also includes a pay increase for corrections officers in state prisons. State workers held demonstrations this week in Tampa, Miami, Tallahassee, and Jacksonville in support of a pay hike. On the House side, things don't look so good for an across-the-board pay increase. Florida House leaders have talked only about what they call targeted pay increases.
So, Lisa, do state workers deserve a pay increase?
Absolutely.
Why?
Florida is a low-wage state where half of our jobs pay less than $15 an hour, and Florida state workers have not gotten an across-the-board raise since before Governor Rick Scott. We consistently rank as the bottom tier of state employees per capita in recent years, and the Sunshine State also ranks among the lowest average of state employee salaries. So I think to question whether state workers deserve a raise is ridiculous, and we definitely need to.
Adam, I think it's interesting that you've got somebody like Bill Galvano who says, at least I'll try to get you one. Because Galvano, conservative Republican, I mean, if he's in that camp, what does that say?
Well, also, when times are reasonably flush, and when you've got an enormous budget like this, it's just hard to justify taking so long before any state employee can get a raise. Mm-hmm. Especially when we have... I think we forever have had the lowest number of state employees per capita. Mm-hmm. In addition to just the size of the level of the pay, we have very few state employees compared to other states per capita.
Holly, I talked to some state workers last week, and they said, look, some of our people are working three jobs to make ends meet, and then some of us are on public assistance because we haven't had a strong pay raise in years.
And if you're working a full-time job or one or two, nobody should have to be on public assistance, but we know that that is the reality of it. And you know, especially the correction officers, we heard from the prison's chief. He testified to the lawmakers about the dire state of the prisons and how much these guards, my dad was a correction officer. I know how hard that job is. And so they're getting a pay raise in addition to the 3% raise of, depending on how much time they've been there, $500 if they've been there so many years, I believe it is. But they're getting a little bit extra in this as well. And the prisons are in bad shape. Mm-hmm. They are working overtime. They need a morale boost here. So this is great news for them if they can get it to go through.
A few years ago, I was talking to a state worker in the prison system. They were paid entry-level $28,000 a year. This is just 4 or 5 years ago to work as a corrections officer.
Imagine raising a family on that.
I can't imagine it. Mike, what do you think about this?
Big shout-out to Senator Galvano, President Galvano, and our governor. Both of them are pushing for increased salaries for our state workers, for our teachers, and both Republicans. And that's a good sign. That's great to see. It's a long time coming for both our teachers, for our state workers. I mean, they haven't had a raise in years. And sadly, we do have some of our state workers who are having to collect food stamps. That's unacceptable. They're hard, dedicated individuals who've been there for years, that no one else, unfortunately, want to take that job if they can find a job in the private sector making a lot more money. So my hope is that the Senate will meet them and support what the president of the Senate, Galvano, wants to do.
Okay. Well, before we go, what other news story should we be paying attention to? And Mike, let's start with you, your other big story of the week.
Well, for Pasco County, for the tax collector's office that I represent, talking about pay raises, when I got there 6 years ago, starting salary was $9.25 an hour. We had people making food stamps. We've changed that over the past 6 years. As of January 1st of this year, our starting salary is now $15.40. So it exceeds Mr. Morgan's constitutional amendment, which I fully support, paying people what they're worth and also making certain that they get a salary that they can live on and support their family with.
All right. Lisa, your other big story?
I'd like to keep an eye on Tallahassee as our legislators assess the school voucher program.
Yep. Wells Fargo is just checking out.
Yeah.
Third Federal is just checking out. Yep. They don't support the school voucher program because some schools are discriminating against LGBTQ students.
Absolutely. Yep. Yeah. And I think we need to really watch that. You know, our lawmakers are shooting for less oversight when I feel like we might want to see some more. So all eyes on that.
All right. Holly, your other big story?
We've been interviewing some lawmakers about various bills that they have on clean water. And there was something that happened at the Capitol last week that I don't think got as much attention as it deserved. A state economist was testifying that by 2025, it's estimated that the demand for fresh water in Florida is not there to meet the demand. And that's just 5 years away. With so many people moving in each day to Florida, that's really something to keep top of mind, I think, in Tallahassee, that we've got to protect our fresh water.
It's almost never talked about.
That's right.
All right. Adam, your other big story.
Well, I was going to say some of these major banks that are pulling out of the school voucher program, but you kind of stole that from me, Ross.
Sorry.
So
you can still say it.
The Rays are now pushing back against the city of St. Pete, playing hardball and suggesting that if the city goes ahead and that they could block the city's redevelopment of that land if the city continues to block their ability to look around.
Are the Rays playing fair when they say that? They say you can't redevelop the land or talk about till 2027?
Well, who's playing fair? You play with what the cards you get, and it may end up getting resolved in court, but if the city's going to play hardball, I suppose it's fair for the Rays to play hardball, too.
All right. Well, thank you all for a great show.
Thank you.
Well, that was Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV, and my guests on that panel, Adam Smith and Holly Gregory were the journalists on that panel. Mike Fasano was the Republican, and Lisa Perry was the Democrat. We got some emails about the topics, and I'll read a few of these emails. One says, it amazes me that Pam Bondi had the audacity to say that Hunter Biden had no clue about what he was doing in his position in the Ukraine. The Trump administration put Rick Perry, a politician, in charge of the Department of Energy, replacing a well-known scientist. Does that mean that Rick Perry knows what he's doing as the Department of Energy head? Writes Anonymous. And then Another person, Charles, says the unending hypocrisy and cherry-picking of issues and information is just dizzying. How anybody got through that segment about Hunter Biden without mentioning the nepotism of the Trump family in our government at the moment is an absolute mystery to me. Oh, wait, it's not that they're all brainwashed by right-wing propaganda, writes Charles. And then another person writes, they say that Hunter Biden didn't know what he was doing when he got his job in Ukraine. Betsy DeVos still doesn't know what she's doing about running public schools. We got this anonymous email saying that we're not pointing out that Pam Bondi is being paid hundreds of thousands of dollars by the country of Qatar for lobbying on behalf of them. And the person writes, what does she know about Qatar? Well, let's change gears a little bit and talk to two guests. Our guests are going to be speaking this Saturday morning at the Unitarian Church in Clearwater as part of the Darwin Day celebration. And their topic is, why are humans moral? And we're joined by Doug Mann, a retired psychologist from the University of Ohio University Medical School, and also Amanda Poppy of the American Ethical Cultural Union. And she is also a minister in the Unitarian Universalist Church, and they'll both be speaking at the Darwin Day celebration this Saturday, February 8th, at the Unitarian Church in Clearwater at 10 a.m. And Amanda and Doug, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much. Good to be with you.
Thanks for coming on. So did I get it right? The topic is, why are humans moral? Is that what you're going to be speaking about? No, I might have lost our guests. Amanda and Doug, can you hear me?
Yep, absolutely. Okay. I'm here.
And Doug, can you hear me? Okay, Doug can't hear us. Not sure.
Oh, funny. Well, I can hear Doug, and he can hear you.
Okay.
So I seem to be able to hear everybody.
All right. Well, Amanda, you take it first. Is that the topic
right,
that you'll
that
be discussing?
Good. Yeah, I think that is most that phrase is most closely linked to Doug's topic. Actually, he's really going to look at sort of, as I understand it, at the evolutionary aspect of morality, kind of where does our morality come from? And as humans, being an animal, among animals, you know, sort of how do we find our morality? So he could say much more about that. I'm actually going to talk a little bit about how human morality continues to shape the world around us, including to shape evolution. So people talk sometimes about how humans are actually, at this point, an evolutionary force, not just in the way that we interact with the environment. We obviously, when we think about climate change, we're going to think about it in that way. But even in the causes that we choose to support, the animals that we choose to save. So the title of my talk is something like pandas are too cute to die, right? We as humans have decided to make sure to save them, even though maybe evolution wouldn't have kept them around without us protecting them.
Interesting. Let me see if I can try to reconnect with Doug. Doug, hold on just a sec. I'm going to try to reconnect here. Doug, can you hear me all right? Okay, we're still not getting him.
But he can hear you. He just said he can hear you.
Yeah, all right. Not sure what the problem is. Go ahead.
He said he's going to call back in, Rob, if that sounds okay.
Yeah, that sounds great. That sounds great.
Great. All right. Go for it, Doug.
All right. So thanks, Doug, for your patience, and sorry about this. So, Amanda, let me ask you. So are you saying that we're interfering with the evolutionary process?
I don't know about interfering. I would say we're part of it. You know, I think, evolution is about how species engage with the environment and how the environment shapes them. And at this point, humans are such a significant part of shaping the environment that we end up really shaping evolution to some extent. I do think that that's right. So, I don't know, interfering, part of.
We're part of. Okay, well, maybe interfering is too strong a word.
Yeah.
So is that a good thing or a bad thing?
No, I think it depends how we interfere, right? It depends how we're part of it. Certainly as we look at the effect of humans and humans' use of technology and the way that we exist right now on the planet, our contribution to climate change, which is essentially entirely because of human use of the planet and the planet's resources can hardly be seen as a good thing. I think, you know, we see every year more populations going extinct, more environments degraded and uninhabitable, and we're starting to see the effect on humans as well. So I think that's a really negative side of it. We also, because of our kind of inherent morality and our inherent, what I would call sort of a draw toward connection, we also have a real pull to save animals, to protect the environment around us. And I think that's where that idea of, you know, pandas being kind of too cute to let die, right? Pandas are incredibly inefficient in their consumption of food. They can only live in a really specific area. If evolution simply took its course with no protection, I think we might see the extinction of some species earlier than we do because humans have sort of prioritized those species. So.
Well, and of course, what humans are doing is taking over the habitat of many of these endangered animals. So whether it's the Florida panther or mm-hmm. the scrub jay here in Florida or the pandas mm-hmm. in China, we're infringing on their what used to be their land, what used to be yep. their, and so in a sense, we're to the detriment of other species. We're saying this land is ours; it's not yours.
Right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. And of course, we have choices about how we do that and what land we protect and, you know, sort of how we exist on the planet in relationship with all the other species that are also here.
Does that show that humans have a negative effect then on the planet, on the equilibrium of species on the planet?
Well, I mean, it certainly shows we can. I tend to avoid sort of putting really big moral statements on what the planet should look like or shouldn't look like. Evolution is not, evolution doesn't have an aim. It just is, right? It's just animals and species reacting and plants reacting to their environment so that they can survive. We as humans put often moral ideas around that. So I think it's a little bit more complicated than humans are good or humans are bad. For sure, much of the way that humans are interacting with resources right now are going to mean that those resources are not available for other species and ultimately for our own species, and that the environment will make it much harder for the majority of species to exist. So that, I would, I'm willing to say that's bad.
So Amanda Pape is the president of the Unitarian Universalist Humanist Association, and also here is Dr. Douglas Mann. Doug is a retired psychologist from the Ohio University Medical School, and his topic is where did morality come from? Is that a shorthand way to say what you'll be talking about this Saturday?
Yes, that's right. It's starting with the fact that it's not widely known that Darwin wrote quite a bit about the evolution of morality in his second major book, The Descent of Man, and he saw human morality as a product of evolution by natural selection. And scientists have been discovering things since that sort of flesh out the general story that Darwin told.
So what kind of morality are we talking about? I mean, give us some examples of what we've developed now in the 21st century that folks might not have, humans might not have experienced thousands of years ago in terms of treating each other and interacting with each other.
Well, yes, it's always been a big challenge for human beings as our population grew and our social units got bigger and cultures became more anonymous, became harder to help each other. But we're still operating, in a sense, on the traits that we have that have been evolving for the last 200 million years since the early mammals, the basic traits of being social and being attached to each other and caring and wanting to be a member of a group and, you know, being able to control ourselves and follow the rules of a group. That's all been in place for probably since for at least 50,000 years. And then we face all the challenges of scaling up to, you know, that face the problems of much larger moral communities.
Well,
so as Amanda mentioned, you know, climate change is a whole new kind of challenge that our species has never faced the consequences of before.
I think there's a whole school of thought, though, that says that you can't have morality without religion, that religion is what gives us our morality, that we get these rules handed down in various religions, and if we follow that, we're a more moral society. If you remove that religion, there will be anarchy, and humans will not treat each other with any sort of caring or concern about group rules or any sort of morality.
Right, and that is a widespread and understandable belief because, you know, religion has had such a crucial role in organizing moral rules and teaching them and helping to enforce them. But basically what science shows us is a couple of things. One is that, you know, our underlying traits that help us to be successful members of a group, to follow the rules and to be moral, have this long evolutionary history. And they don't just disappear if your cultural beliefs change a little bit. And, you know, as a modern example, you can look at a number of Scandinavian countries that have happy populations and they're prosperous and highly successful. They're not particularly religious anymore. So we can have positive cultural moral beliefs that draw on those traits we have of wanting to get along, of wanting to care for each other. And those things don't just disappear if our beliefs change a little bit.
You know, when we talk about Darwin, I always think of the survival of the fittest. There is a whole slew of television programs and movies out there these days in which zombies and vampires and aliens attack the U.S. And the message in the movies, or attack people rather, and the message in the movies is fight back or you're going to be killed. That the only way to survive any sort of anarchical situation or, you know, collapse of society is arm yourself and kill everybody who's not part of your tribe. In Independence Day, they make fun of people that are greeting the aliens arriving in the U.S. with welcome signs and peace signs, and those folks are all wiped out immediately by the aliens. But I wonder what you think about the movies these days and the TV shows that suggest that if society nears a breakdown, the only way that you're going to survive is to arm yourself and be militant.
Well, society is under a lot of stress when those kind of things happen, and people's moral circles tend to shrink down to a smaller, you know, in-group where you trust your in-group and maybe you don't trust the out-group. But we still have a choice of whether we can try to operate on our best pro-social traits or give in to fear. And that depends a lot on moral leadership. You know, all these phrases that are so vivid, survival of the fittest, nature red in tooth and claw, selfish genes, all that kind of promotes an idea that evolution is just about ruthless competition. And Darwin saw that side of things, you know, that animals compete for food and so on. But then he looked at the results of evolution and how, you know, harmonious a lot of relationships are in nature and how the most successful species are highly social and succeeded by being cooperative. So we can't let ourselves just throw that away when we get stressed by some new circumstance.
And that side of cooperation is almost always left out of these disaster movies, if I could use that as a shorthand. Well, our guests are Douglas Mann, and Douglas is a retired experimental psychologist and former medical school professor at Ohio University Medical School. And also here is Amanda Poppe of the American Ethical Culture Union, rather. And I'm sorry about that.
No problem.
They'll both be speaking this Saturday, February 8th at 10 a.m. at the Octagon Arts Center on Nursery Road in Clearwater. It's part of the Darwin Day celebration that a local group puts on, the Tampa Bay Coalition of Reason. So, Amanda, you're also a certified ethical culture leader. What is ethical culture?
Sure. So it is essentially a religious or a philosophical tradition that started actually in the 19th century, so 1876 it was founded. It's not new. I think a lot of people think of it in that way, in part because humanism has really grown in the 20th century and into the 21st century, but it's actually an older tradition, and it's really based on the idea that people can believe differently than each other and act together for justice in the world. So I serve a congregation in Washington, D.C., and the congregation has atheists and agnostics in it. It's got some theists and Christians and you know, people from just a whole lot of different backgrounds, all of us trying to live good lives and create a better world together. When you were asking, Doug, earlier about sort of that common fallacy that, you know, if you don't have morale, if you don't have religion, you can't have morality. And I loved your example, Doug, you know, both sort of the evolution of morality and the way that you see it really consistent across cultures and through religious traditions. And I have just such practical, a practical viewpoint on that because I serve a congregation of, you know, 350 folks who are really dedicated to living good lives, the majority of them without what folks would consider traditional religious values or traditional religious beliefs, but that are really focused on how to treat others well, how to create a better world for people, how to preserve our environment. Those are such core things. And I see people just living that every day.
And Amanda, is there a code that you live by? I mean, you know, in some groups, there's the Ten Commandments, for instance.
Yeah, sure.
And what code do you live by?
Well, so it's a creedless tradition, so there's no particular set of creed or set of beliefs that people are required to ascribe to. We do tend to hold a couple really core values. One of those is the worth of every single person, that no matter what, no matter what value you add to society, no matter, you know, what you do or where you come from, you are worthy. And then the other is that we are... we exist in relationship with each other. None of us exist singly, alone, individually, but always in relationship with other people and with the world around us. And I think a lot of our justice work comes out of those two ideas. You know, if you believe every person is worthy and that we're all in relationship with each other, then we're really called to create a world where everybody's worth is honored and everybody can flourish.
And Amanda, does everybody in your congregation there in Washington, D.C., do they are they all Democrats or all liberals, or do you have...
Well, I mean, again, it's creedless, so there's no voter ID test when you come in, you know. You know, the congregation does tend to be progressive in its values. It's not all Democrats. I don't, you know, and... Because we are a religious body, we would be nonpartisan anyway. So the work that we do is around issues, around people's rights, around the environment, not around political candidates. We couldn't do that, nor would we want to. I think for us, it's really about the broader moral values. And any candidate that is supporting the broader moral values of inherent worth, of the dignity of every person, and creating a world where all of us can live... you know, that would be the kind of candidate that we would support, I suspect, individually, regardless of party, more about the values that they represent.
Doug, let me go back to you. Are you worried about the direction that U.S. society is going in? We hear, you know, that the U.S. is really divided, especially over President Trump these days, and... in some corners, there's talk of civil war. We see armed militia groups going to the state capitol in Virginia, just kind of showing their might. And you know, let's hope it doesn't even come close to that. But I mean, are you worried that about the direction of the U.S. at all?
Oh, sure, we are. You know. Strongly polarized, and some of our technologies, like social media, that we thought were going to be so great for bringing people together, tend to play into that polarization when people stay in their own political bubbles, which is a real shame because, you know, from studying moral psychology, you know, people who are liberal may value individual rights a little more, and people who are conservative may favor loyalty to the group or the nation slightly more. But both groups value both things. It's just a matter of a slightly different balance. So there's plenty of common ground. Unfortunately, our political processes and social media processes seem to have gotten us pretty polarized, and it's going to be a little hard to break out of.
So you'll both be speaking this Saturday at the Octagon Arts Center at 10 a.m. as part of the Tampa Bay Coalition of Reason marking Darwin Day. And thank you both for coming on. Doug, have you written a book, or do you have a website that people could look at?
Not yet at this point. I've written a couple of articles for the Free Inquiry magazine, and I am working on a book, but thank you for asking.
Okay, and Amanda Poppy of the American Ethical Culture Union. There I go again.
Sure, it's actually the American Ethical Union, so folks can check that out at aeu.org. They can check out the congregation that I serve, the Washington Ethical Society, at ethicalsociety.org. And if they're interested in Unitarian Universalism, which is a religious tradition that embraces humanists and theists and really quite a broad variety of theological viewpoints, they can check that out at uua.org. So a few places to learn more.
All right, Amanda Poppy and Douglas Mann, thank you very much for coming on WMNF.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
All right, great to have you here. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM, and in a moment we'll open up the phone lines and take phone calls for the last few minutes of the show. Lots of emails have come in, and Melanie writes this regarding Rick Scott running for president. Melanie writes, "Unfortunately, it looks like the horse has left the barn in the 2020 election. I feel that the current resident of the White House will have no trouble keeping his position. The Democrats absolutely need to find a shining star to run in 2024. Right now, if they don't, we may be living in a police state," writes Melanie, who's in Sun City Center. Melanie, thank you very much. And thanks to Anonymous for a contribution to WMNF. Thank you, Anonymous, for that nice contribution from Clearwater. And then Liz writes this, "As the Democratic Clinton elite establishment DNC holdovers try to hang on to power by undermining the true progressives and the corporate media misrepresenting facts to undermine true progressives, it is pissing us off," writes Liz in Spring Hill, "the grassroots, that is, by trying to interfere with the people hearing the truth." So that's a part of Liz's email out there. Liz, thank you for that. Kevin writes this, "So our state workers are underpaid, our teachers are underpaid, and over half of Florida's workers earn less than $15 an hour. Anyone wondering who's responsible for this? They should thank Red Tide Rick Scott," writes Kevin. And David writes this, "If the Democratic Party changes its rules in the middle of the primary to campaign to accommodate a billionaire former Republican and torpedo Bernie Sanders, it will divide the majority of voters who want to dump Trump, crush the Democratic base, alienate millions of young voters, and guarantee a second term for Trump," writes David. That's part of his email. And then Bill writes this, "Religion will destroy the human race. It's easy to see," writes Bill. Bill, thank you for that. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Let's take a phone call from Rob in Thanodosassa. Rob, what would you like to say in Thanodosassa?
Hey, Rob, that was a fascinating segment there at the end. I enjoyed listening to your guests. I wish I could have directed this question at them, but I'll make the comment that, you know, religion, I think, the way people view religion is it's they get the horse before the cart thing. It's not that it creates morality. It's that it reflects increasingly complex social interactions as people tended to accumulate in larger and larger conglomerations or get together in larger conglomerations, you know, in more urban areas. And what I think people like Jesus were saying, if, you know, let's assume he existed or someone like him, and that perhaps his teachings were in some way, you know, misinterpreted or blended with other teachings, like Paul or someone, that people, the body of Christ isn't just the church. What it is, it's everyone having a place in a larger entity, a larger social body. Hello?
No, you're still there.
Oh, a larger social body, much the way parts of a cell combine to create something larger than itself while also being individual, or organs of a human body or any animal body having their individual form, a heart, lungs, kidney, but yet they're all contributing to a larger body. And I think that, you know, we are social animals and that we have to learn to get along, and that's what morality is. it's practical in some sense, because we can't exist at each other's throats. We can't exist trying to put the other person down.
That's really true, Rob, and I wish we had more time, but we're out of time. But thanks, Rob, for calling in. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115 about this show. And thanks to Frank Knox. He's been our phone producer today. Stay tuned. Sean Cannon is coming up next with some students who are in Iowa and they're